the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to journey number 125 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring the ratification of the United States Constitution. I'm your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. You know, here in the United States, there's a patriotic celebration coming up in July, July 4th, Independence Day, celebrating the Declaration of Independence, when the English colonies on the North American continent declared their independence from England, from the King of England, which eventually, of course, led to the Revolutionary War. I was very tempted to do a journey into history for July 4th, 1776. But I, for various reasons, decided to start the celebration early, so to speak, and to instead feature this date, June 25th. At least I hope this goes out on June 25th. Featuring the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. This isn't celebrated as a holiday or a special occasion here in the United States, but I think it's quite significant, and actually probably more significant and dramatic than the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Of course, that's hard to beat, right? But I think as we talk about the U.S. Constitution and several of the debates and several of the things that were talked about, it was a pretty monumental task to get all 13 colonies to ratify this document that has represented this country ever since. And it stood the test of time. And there's been amendments made, and we'll definitely explore those things as we talk today. And so let's get right into it. Let's jump into the CBS presentation of You Are There and move on from there. So come with me and let's journey into a new America where they were about to establish a new groundbreaking form of government.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare at hand, secure the blessings of liberty, to ourselves and our posterity do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
This is John Daly at Convention Hall, Richmond, Virginia. On this 25th day of June, 1788, the Virginia Ratifying Convention has been taken completely by surprise. Mr. Edmund Randolph, present governor of Virginia, has come out publicly in favor of the proposed federal constitution for the United States of America. As a delegate to this crucial convention, and up to now an avowed enemy of the Constitution, Governor Randolph has been a leader in the campaign against ratification. But he has just told reporters that he will speak and vote for ratification when the convention reconvenes to vote a few minutes from now. Thus, the Constitution, which would unite the 13 American states under a strong central government, has found a powerful friend in an unexpected quarter.
June 25th, 1788, the Convention Hall, Richmond, Virginia. You are there.
Virginia, key state in the plan to form the 13 original states into a united America, stands undecided, torn by dissension, and the Constitution hangs in the balance. CBS takes you back 160 years to the day that determined whether Americans could go forward from revolution and establish a stable central government. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical facts and quotations. And now,
Virginia, the Richmond Convention Hall, and John Daly.
A group of reporters hurriedly summoned to the governor's executive chamber a few minutes ago. Asked why he is turning from the party of Patrick Henry to the party of James Madison, Governor Randolph would not amplify his statement, saying only that he will give the reasons which prompted his move on the floor of the convention. And we hurried from that news conference to this microphone here on the convention floor to bring you this news. There's Mr. James Monroe, one of Mr. Patrick Henry's chief lieutenants, in the fight against ratification. Mr. Monroe!
Sir?
Sir, are you aware that Governor Randolph has gone over to the Federalist Party?
I am indeed.
Would you care to comment on it, Mr. Monroe?
Any remarks on Governor Randolph's strange conduct will come from Mr. Henry, the leader of our party.
But how do you think Governor Randolph's action will affect the vote on ratification, sir?
No comment, sir. No comment.
Mr. Monroe has turned away from the microphone. Our brief conversation, a mark of the confusion Governor Randolph's change of mind has produced here. Ned Kelmer's been analyzing the possibilities inherent in Governor Randolph's action and is ready now with his report. So over to our CBS headquarters booth here in Convention Hall and Ned Kelmer.
Governor Randolph's sudden allegiance to the Federalists may have a decisive effect on this convention. Roughly half of the delegates represent the cities, towns, and the Tidewater planters, and the other half come from the rural districts. Generally speaking, the planters and the businessmen are in favor of a national constitution. They are haunted by memories of Daniel Shea's rebellion in Massachusetts last year, and they want the constitution as an instrument to end social chaos. On the other hand, the rural delegates, by and large, oppose the constitution. At present, they're paying their debts with cheap state paper money, and they fear that national currency reforms would work to their disadvantage. But Governor Randolph has much influence and prestige among the country delegates. His change of position may very well swing the necessary votes from among them to carry the ratification. Thus, what happens here in Virginia today may decide the destiny of America. As you know, 9 states must ratify the proposed Constitution if it's to supplant the Articles of Confederation. 8 states have already ratified, and 4 others probably will not. If Virginia fails to ratify, the Constitution is likely to be doomed. And in that case, just a moment, Governor Randolph, at his executive mansion, has consented to grant our reporter, Don Hollenbeck, a brief interview before departing for this convention hall. So over to Don Hollenbeck at the governor's mansion.
Governor Randolph, sir, will you tell us why you've made this last-minute turn from the Anti-Constitution Party to the Federalists?
I have joined the Federalists because the Anti-Constitution Party has caused too much, far too much delay on the pressing issue of a strong central government.
Why do you feel that we need a strong central government such as the proposed Constitution outlines?
It is imperative. The union of the states sags apart for want of it. Mr. Henry fails to see the danger. He occupies himself with legalistic assaults on various phases of the Constitution without realizing that the measure as a whole is desperately needed.
Well, Governor, do you endorse the proposed Constitution in toto without amendments?
No, I do not. I hope and trust that certain amendments will subsequently be adopted, such as a Bill of Rights and a clause absolutely forbidding the importation of Negro slaves. But all that can come later. Time is running out. And we cannot go on under the Articles of Confederation.
Thank you, Governor Randolph. This is Don Hollenbeck returning you now to John Daly on the floor of Convention Hall.
About 80 delegates are here now, and among them is Mr. Patrick Henry, former governor of Virginia, leader of the Anti-Constitution Party. He's wearing the ill-fitting wig and shabby black coat for which he is famous, and his hawk-like face is grim and forbidding. Mr. Henry! Sir, would you care to comment on Governor Randolph's repudiation of the Anti-Constitution Party?
Governor Randolph, bah! My opponents are welcome to him. He, like they, has turned his back on the revolution. He's divorced himself from the common people and embraced that hydra-headed monster, property.
Well, do you mean to suggest, sir, that the Constitution favors the property-holding classes of the nation?
Yes. May I charge you? The worship of private property is implicit in every article of that infamous document. 1 year ago, sir, at Philadelphia, the Constitution stank so noisomely that Governor Randolph refused to sign it. Does it smell any sweeter now? No. The Constitution remains unchanged. It is Edmund Randolph who has changed. Randolph. An empty sail billowing with the wind from the tidewater.
Are you implying, Mr. Henry, that Governor Randolph has yielded to pressure from the tidewater plantation?
No, no. Randolph was born with a golden spoon in his mouth. He is rich. He has many slaves. He is also a politician and, as such, he flirted briefly with the ideas of liberty and equality. But the governor has seen the light. Property is the thing that counts.
Well, wouldn't you say, sir, that the protection of private property is important for the welfare of the country?
Important, yes. But human rights are equally important. And where, I ask you, where do you find one single mention of human rights in this Constitution that we are asked to ratify today?
But if that is so, Mr. Henry, how do you explain that 8 states have already ratified the Constitution?
Citizens of those 8 states would bargain away their heritage of freedom for a mess of pots. For my part, give me liberty, greatest of all earthly blessings. Give me that precious jewel, and you may take everything else.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. Here comes Mr. Madison. He's a small man and quiet of voice, but Mr. Madison yields to no man in intellectual capacity. Indeed, he is as famous for the logic of his arguments as Mr. Patrick Henry is for the brilliance of his oratory. Mr. Madison! Mr. Madison, Mr. Henry has just charged that the Constitution places property rights above human rights.
An interesting phrase. But then, Patrick Henry is a master of interesting phrases. One of them helped to start our revolution. The trouble is, Mr. Henry is in a constant state of revolution. He should remember that the war is over, and that his antagonists in this hall are not redcoats.
Yes, Mr. Madison, but what about his argument, sir?
Ah, yes. Property rights above human rights. Well, now, suppose we examine that without the benefit of oratory, shall we? Mr. Henry would give you the impression that this is a struggle between the rich and the poor, the strong and the weak. The fact is, sir, that there are wealthy men who hate the Constitution and poor men who love it. The point is that all Americans, rich and poor, are in dire straits today because we have no strong central government. Mr. Henry poses as the shining knight of liberty. But where, sir, is liberty without order? Order is what we need, not at the expense of human rights, but precisely to render them secure.
Well, Mr. Madison, it's been reported that Mr. Thomas Jefferson, our ambassador to France, is against the Constitution.
That, sir, is a distortion. Mr. Jefferson is a friend of mine. I'm in constant correspondence with him. It is true that he disagrees with some aspects of the Constitution, but on the whole, he favors it. As a matter of fact, it would be well for Mr. Henry to remember there are other patriots of the War for Independence who stand behind the Constitution, not only Thomas Jefferson, but General Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, John Dickinson, and a host of others.
Thank you, Mr. Madison.
A pleasure, sir.
Well, you've heard that the Constitution would be of great benefit to all Americans, and you've also heard that it will benefit only the rich. Outside this Virginia Hall, there's a representative crowd waiting for the result of the vote, and Ken Roberts is out there. So let's switch to him and find out how these people feel about the Constitution. Go ahead, Ken Roberts.
In this crowd, judging by their dress, are people from every section and class of Virginia. I see men who are obviously planters, others who must be tradesmen, and a large number of farming folk. Some of them must have come a long way to be in Richmond at this fateful hour. Here, for instance, is a tall man wearing a fringed shirt and a coonskin cap. Where are you from, sir?
I be from Plainville, in the Western District.
You're a delegate, sir?
Nay. I come here to watch over the delegates.
Oh?
Want to be sure they vote the way they're supposed to.
And how are the delegates of the Western District supposed to vote, Mr.
Holloway, Thomas Holloway, and they're still supposed to vote against the Constitution when Governor Randolph will be paying for turning his court on us come next election.
Would you mind telling us why you're against the Constitution, Mr. Holloway?
See this bullet wound in my left arm? I received it 10 years ago, come September. I received it fighting to free Virginia from the rule of King George.
Don't you mean that you were fighting to free the United States?
Nay, to free Virginia.
But aren't you a citizen of the United States?
Nay, I'm a citizen of Virginia. We fought to be rid of the third George, and we want no fourth to take his place.
Then you think the Constitution would result in a king being imposed on the American state?
Aye.
What makes you think so?
If there be a Constitution, there'll be a president. If there be a president, he'll waste no time making himself into a monarch.
But, Mr. Holloway, it's generally agreed that if the Constitution is ratified, the first president of the United States will be General George Washington.
Aye. He'll waste no time making himself into a monarch.
Do you think that General Washington, if elected, will establish a monarchy?
Aye. There'll be nothing in the Constitution to stop him if he's a mind to. And I reckon he'll have a mind to. Power would be spoiling a man, say I. There's always
that.
Mr. Holloway has just been interrupted by a well-dressed man in the crowd.
Would you have the mind to be crying at me if I'm
going to be switching the reputation of the best man in the world?
Gentlemen, just a moment. Sir, we'll be glad to have your opinions on General Washington and the Constitution after Mr. Holloway has said.
For himself, I have no
now, Mr. Holloway, you were just saying General Washington will make himself king if the Constitution is ratified.
Aye, and he could do it. According to the Constitution, the president would have his own standing army.
Yes, but wouldn't the army be subject to the decisions of the federal Congress?
With a gun at its throat, what could the Congress do? He'll be making himself monarch. Congress or no?
Thank you, Mr. Holloway. Now, sir, now you have your opportunity.
He'll tell you now, he's an empty head, that.
Empty head, I would tell you, see, abuse, canard, that's the way with you rascals.
Rascals.
You impute the most stunning words to the patriots who frame the Constitution. You don't want the truth.
Gentlemen, we were discussing something else. Let's get back to the Constitution.
The Constitution. I predict, sir, that unless the Constitution is ratified, the merchants of this country will be ruined. Yeah. Wiped out utterly.
Are you a merchant, sir?
Yes, sir, I am. I am a merchant, sir. I trade in tobacco and fine Virginia leaf, sir. Ask anyone in Richmond, you'll find that Ralph Barker handles only the best.
And you feel that the Constitution, if ratified, would be a boon to business?
Absolutely, sir. Business is bad today. Oh, bad, very bad. And my warehouse is bursting with unsold tobacco. The country is in a depression. And it's because of the money situation. It's scandalous. Absolutely.
Would you explain that, please, Mr. Barker?
Yes, you explain.
I will if you would only give me a chance. My word, there are so many different kinds of money in circulation. It's like a man in
that was it.
Doubloons, pistoles, gold johannesses, English, French crowns, English guineas, Spanish dollars.
But,
and to cap it all, the states are issuing money that isn't worth the paper it's printed on. Now, how on earth can a merchant do business under such conditions?
It must be difficult.
Necessary. Difficult? Why, it's impossible. It's confusion compounded into an unholy mess.
And you feel that the Constitution, if ratified, would restore order in interstate commerce and regulate the currency?
Yes, sir, I do. Of course I do. The Constitution specifically...
This is John Daly in Convention Hall. We have interrupted Ken Roberts because Governor Randolph has just come in. He entered by a side door to avoid the crowd outside. Now he is walking down the aisle, and the tension here is so thick one can literally feel it. Mr. Henry has just snubbed Governor Randolph, and the snub was unmistakable. His face pale, the governor has walked to his seat, sits down, shakes hands with Mr. Madison. Now the gavel sounds. Mr. Pendleton, president of the convention, is calling the delegates to order. The final debate will begin in a few moments. As you know, the resolution embodying the Constitution has already been debated clause by clause in the 3 weeks this convention has been in session. And now, Mr. Pendleton.
The Virginia ratifying convention is hereby declared to be officially convened. By previous agreement, the final speech in opposition to ratification will be made by Mr. Patrick Henry. And he will be followed by Mr. James Madison, who will speak in favor of ratification of the proposed federal constitution. I now recognize the first speaker, Mr. Henry.
And Patrick Henry rises, walking slowly up the aisle. He's moving toward the front of the hall. Now he's mounting the rostrum. His hawk-like eyes under that ragged wig look out piercingly around the room. And they have come to rest on Governor Randolph. Mr. Henry stares at the governor now with an expression of, well, you might almost call it contempt. And now Mr. Henry is about to speak.
My concluding remarks in behalf of the Anti-Constitution Party, the Party of Liberty, will be brief. But I would first make a few observations on the conduct of one of the delegates. I am referring to none other than Governor Edmund Randolph. Last year in Philadelphia, Governor Randolph denounced the Constitution. It seems to me very strange that that which was then the subject of his denunciation should today become the object of his praise. Something extraordinary must have happened to operate so great a change in his opinion.
Mr. President! Mr. President!
Governor Randolph is calling for the floor. He's been ruled out of order. Now, Mr. Henry.
I yield to the member. Let us hear what the honorable member has to say.
The honorable speaker hints that I have changed my opinions for some hidden and therefore discreditable reason.
I have no personal intention of offending anyone. I merely do my duty.
The gentleman smiles when he says that. His conduct is malicious, and it is not compatible with the least shadow of friendship. Very well. If our friendship must fall, let it fall like Lucifer, never to rise again.
Does the member accuse me of malicious behavior?
I believe the meaning of my words is clear.
Is the member prepared to back up his remarks with deeds?
If the gentleman seeks satisfaction, he will find my second place.
I thank the gentleman for his willingness to render satisfaction. Mr. President, I request a short recess in order to arrange the details of a matter of honor.
This is unprecedented. However, due to the member's request is granted, I hereby declare a 5-minute recess.
Mr. Randolph and Mr. Henry are leaving the hall, no doubt to choose and confer with their second, as is traditional in these affairs of honor among gentlemen. This is a startling turn of events, and we'll try and bring you the developments just as fast as we can. The floor here is a scene of confusion. The delegates are milling about, shouting and arguing, shaking their fists at each other, and from the look of things here, it would almost seem that there'll be more affairs of honor out there on the floor of this convention hall unless this convention is called back into order, and very soon. And there's Mr. Pendleton. Mr. Pendleton, sir, will the session resume in spite of this conflict between Mr. Henry and Mr. Randolph?
Yes, I will reconvene in 5 minutes.
And the vote will be taken as scheduled, sir?
Certainly.
Do you have anything to say on that?
No, please.
All right, thank you, Mr. Pendleton. The debate will continue. The vote will be taken despite this dramatic interruption. As you know, Mr. Henry is one of the principal speakers, and he must be back before the convention can properly be reconvened. As I said before, the floor is a scene of confusion, and there is a chance there will be more of these affairs of honor unless the convention is indeed called back into session, and very soon. But now I've seen Ned Kelmer out there circulating quickly among the delegates to learn how Mr. Henry's attack on Governor Randolph will affect the vote. So let's go over to our CBS headquarters booth and Ned Kelmer.
Thanks. Well, on the basis of my brief conversations with the delegates just now, it's safe to say that Mr. Henry, by his open attack on Mr. Randolph, has restored the situation to what it was before the governor came out in favor of the Constitution. Yes, I'd say there's no doubt about that. The delegates from the rural districts admire forceful speech and prompt action. They saw it today, and no matter what outsiders may think of Mr. Henry's conduct, well, his action sits well with the country people. These rural delegates, who might have been shaken by Governor Randolph's new allegiance to the Federalists, now seem to be back in the anti-Constitution fold definitely. And it does look as if the Constitution may fail of ratification. And we... Now Mr. Pendleton has called the convention to order again, so back to John Daly on the convention floor.
The Republic itself.
The delegates are again seated. The convention has reconvened, and Mr. Henry has resumed the floor and is speaking on the resolution embodying the proposed federal constitution of the United States of America. Now let's listen to Mr. Patrick Henry.
Exclusion of the four remaining states.
Congress under this proposed constitution would have a tyrant's power and more. It could lay whatever taxes it chooses. With a standing army, it could keep the people in submission. The president, if he should be ruthless and able, could make himself an absolute ruler. I would rather have a king, lords, and a house of commons than a government complete with such insupportable evils. Gentlemen, my opponents ask you to surrender not only the sword and the purse, but the very scales of justice. Ratify this constitution, and you place our state courts at the mercy of federal courts. A monstrous creation. I dread popular resistance to this proposed government. So vague, so indefinite, so ambiguous in its assurances of liberty and human rights. Let me warn you in the most emphatic terms of the dreadful effects which must ensue should the people resist. I beg, I beseech the delegates to search their consciences and vote nay, nay on this resolution, lest they rouse the people to rebellion in defense of their God-given liberties.
Mr. Henry has left the rostrum, and Mr. Madison is coming up now to speak. He carries his hat in his hand. Now he's taking some slips of paper out of the hat. They are the notes for his address, and he's waiting for the convention to come to order.
The chair recognizes Mr. James Madison.
Mr. President, fellow delegates, I yield to no man in my respect for the previous speaker. Yet in these brief concluding remarks, I would point out that his objections to the Constitution arise out of misunderstanding. This is not strange because the form of government we are proposing is new, unique in the history of the world. Let the delegates, therefore, not measure it by outmoded standards. Mr. President, the American states have stirred the admiration of the world by setting up free governments under the pressure of war. How much more will they win admiration if they should be able peaceably to establish one central government when not cemented by common danger? But will the states achieve that goal? Suppose only 8 states ratify and Virginia refuses to become the 9th except on her own terms. Then even if the others agree to our terms, which is doubtful, every state must call new conventions to consider the amendments. There will be endless disagreements. Every state will be encouraged to offer its own amendments. Agreement will be even more difficult to reach than it was in Philadelphia. In short, Mr. President, if Virginia holds out today, the United States may never have a functioning central government. But if Virginia ratifies the Constitution, it may bring the most fortunate event in the history of mankind. I therefore respectfully submit that the honorable delegates vote yea on the resolution before us. The resolution containing the Constitution of the United States of America.
Mr. Madison replaces his notes in his hat and leaves the rostrum, and from the floor, many voices calling the question. Mr. Pendleton is raising his gavel.
The convention will now vote on the resolution embodying the proposed Constitution for the United States of America. The vote will be by a show of hands. A simple majority will decide. Those delegates who are in favor, those who wish to vote aye on the proposition, will raise their right hand.
Hands are going up all over the hall, and the tellers are moving about counting. A total of 166 votes will be cast. 84 are necessary to carry or defeat the resolution. And it seems now as if half the number of delegates here have their hands up, but it's impossible to tell exactly. However, it's going to be close. You can be sure of that. Very close. We'll know the result in a moment from the eye count. If it's 84 or over, the eyes will have it, and the Constitution will be ratified here in the Virginia Convention and will become the law of the land. The tellers have completed their count now and are moving up to report to the rostrum. They're at the rostrum. Mr. Pendleton is receiving their reports, checking the totals, and we'll know in a moment. Mr. Pendleton.
The tellers report. In favor of the resolution, 89 votes.
The resolution. Central government. We're to have a president, a Congress, a federal judiciary, a national army under the Constitution. I have a copy here in my hand, and its preamble begins, "We, the people of the United States, in order
June 25th, 1788, Virginia ratifies the Constitution and government of, by, and for the people begins."
The ratification of the Constitution was another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne. The program was written by Michael Sklar. Thomas Chalmers played Patrick Henry, Richard Waring was James Madison, Eric Dressler played Governor Randolph, and the cast included Carl Swenson, Chester Stratton, Bernard Lenro, Guy Sorrell, and others. Footnote: the Virginia Convention debated and voted under the impression that it was the ninth necessary ratifying state. The ninth necessary state was actually New Hampshire. It had ratified 4 days earlier. Mr. Madison, Mr. Henry, and their colleagues did not know this because in those days news traveled slowly. Beginning next week, You Are There will be broadcast regularly over most of these stations at a new time, 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for You Are There next week and thereafter. Next week,
November 7th, 1637, Puritan New England, the trial of Anne Hutchinson. You are there.
This is CBS, where 99 million people gather every week, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
So that's how it all went down. Back in 1788. Back on this date in 1788. What's exciting to me about this date in history is that, you know, the U.S. Constitution, this forming of a new government, wasn't just something that was put together. It wasn't just a natural consequence of we declared independence, we fought and won the Revolutionary War, and as it happens, this new document comes out to form a nation. This really was something that was new. It really was something that was never tried before. And Simon's going to get into that. I don't want to steal his thunder. But it's exciting to me that not everybody agreed that this was something that was hashed out, that there were compromises made, that there were things that people brought up that needed to be addressed. And they were. And as things came up later with the Bill of Rights and the other amendments to the Constitution, that these things were addressed and can be addressed today. It's exciting to be a part of that, to be part of that history and to have that legacy that we reap the benefits from today, as well as the debates, as well as many of the political objectives and items that come up. I really enjoyed hearing what Simon had to say, and I know you will too. So let's get on with it. Let's turn you over to Simon, and the rest is history.
Hi, this is Simon Salt, and you are listening to The Rest is History. So we just listened to the ratification of the US Constitution. What an amazing document. As we heard in the broadcast, this was a wholly new type of government, something that had not been attempted before anywhere in the world, and The eyes of the world were upon America. Could these 13 disparate colonies, who, although bound by an article of the Articles of Confederation, actually coalesce into a new nation, the nation of America, the United States? We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Powerful words. But who were we, the people? There had been many arguments leading up to this. Exactly who were the people of America? The early colonists, for example, considered that the people of America were freeborn Englishmen. Interesting that Americans were only Americans if they'd born in England. Of course, that changed. But freeborn Englishmen, and what that really meant was moneyed and those who owned land, the landowners, the gentry. These were the people who counted. These were the people who mattered. And these were the people who owned property. And that property included, of course, land, buildings, livestock, plantations, crops, women, and slaves. So these were the people who were we, the people. Who they were not was women, slaves, and enslaved Indians, natives. So when it came to the discussion of who we, the people, would be, it was very clear that it would be the traditional view of the voting masses, white men. They were the people who are referred to in the Constitution. Now, of course, subsequent amendments have recognized the folly of this. But we have to think about the time. The two major criticisms of the Constitution when it was first placed before the delegates was that it made no comment about the importation of people, slavery, and it made no reference to the Bill of Rights of human beings. What rights could an individual expect in this new United States of America? Madison and the Federalists argued that there was no need for a Bill of Rights, that the Constitution, as it was written, confined the powers of government such that no citizen had anything to fear from the government. The Anti-Federalists argued that without rights being specifically stated in the Constitution, then it would be all too easy for the government and potentially the president to overstep their powers and set up themselves as an ultimate power. And when we look at this, and you look at, as the broadcast talks about, the difference between the two parties, the Madison's party of the Federalists, Patrick Henry of the Anti-Federalists, the Anti-Constitution, and they really split the country. And in effect, they constituted an almost north-south divide, something that has long plagued the later United States. And the reason those two were divided was, again, the same reason that it divided them later in the Civil War. The North, or those who were industrialists who were focused on building cities and towns and bringing industry from Europe and technology innovations to the country were on the one side, and the rural plantation owners were on the other. Those that believed in a more agrarian society, those that believed in an arable society, they held that all human beings deserve to have a Bill of Rights. Of course, they in turn did not include slaves or enslaved Indians, or for that matter, women in that terminology. Both sides agreed that people were white men. It wasn't until much later that we see a recognition of women and, of course, of the evil of slavery, and much later before we see the abolition of the importation of human beings and then the eventual end to slavery. So why were these things missed, and why was it that the Federalists prevailed for the most part? Well, the simple answer to that is money. In much the same way as today, as those with enough financial backing seem to win more often in electoral runoffs, so it was then. The industrialists simply had more money. Their economy was based on tangibles. It was based on products and the ability to produce something physical and tangible and bring it to market and sell it for a large margin. The South, however, or the rural states, of course, relied on the weather. They relied on the land. And that was what controlled their wealth, their ability to extract value from the land itself. And of course, their economy was based quite falsely on the use of what they thought of as almost free labor. Of course, slavery is not free labor. You still have to buy the slaves, you have to transport them, you have to feed them, however meagerly, and you have to look after them, however poorly. But nonetheless, they saw this as part of their economy. This is why they were so defensive of it. Without slavery, the land value would have had to have been much lower, and the product produced from it would have been lower. So their profits would have been lower, and therefore their ability to make money would have been lower. They would have, in fact, lost the incentive to settle that land. They came from agricultural elements in Europe, southern Britain, Holland and France, and other parts, and Germany, other parts of Europe, where they could find new lands to employ their agricultural technology, which was fairly limited at the time. So here we have it. We have this runoff between an industrial-minded group of people and a more agricultural-minded group of people. And it becomes a war of economies, just as the Civil War would become 100 years later. So why did they finally pass the Constitution? Well, in the end, after much debate and much pressure, Madison ceded that, in fact, a Bill of Rights was necessary. It would not be written into the Constitution, but would be adopted as amendments, thus allowing the passage of the Constitution and the ratification of the United States by each of the individual states. But slavery remained something that would be discussed again and again, as was religious freedom. This was part of that Bill of Rights, this right to worship how, where, and who you pleased, without interference from the government. The right of privacy from the government, and the right to live a life in pursuit of liberty and happiness. And the extension of those rights to include all people, regardless of gender or color, regardless of place of birth. One could argue that we are still, as a nation, struggling to grant these rights. That, as a nation, the United States is still divided. Economically, politically, it is divided along lines between those who feel that all people are created equal and those that believe some lives have greater value than others. This is not the place for that argument. The Constitution and the discussions that led to it and its final ratification laid out a framework, but as has been questioned many times since, this document is now 200 years old. Is it still applicable? Has it withstood the test of time? Some argue yes, absolutely, it is as vital a document today as it was when it was written and drafted and ratified. Others would argue that it is no longer applicable to modern society, that it has not, through either through amendment or revision, been updated to take into account the mood of society, the progress of society, the technology of society, and perhaps more importantly, it has not been updated to reflect the place of the United States in the global economy. You have to think back when this document was written, the United States as an economic power didn't exist. In fact, part of the reason that there had to be a declaration of independence was so that the Americans could seek help from France and Spain, who were in their own right monarchies and had every right to view the Americans as simply rebellious against a fellow monarch. Not that they wanted to view it that way, but without a declaration, there was no legal basis for the Americans to ask for and get parley with foreign governments. And of course, the natural extension of that is then to establish a constitution. Having declared yourself a legal entity, there has to be some form of document that defines how this legal entity will conduct itself, both domestically and internationally. But at the time, America, other than being an interesting model for the world to watch, had no real significant power. Of course, that has changed dramatically in the last 200 plus years. And people would argue, some people would argue, that the document itself needs revision, that it needs to reflect better the realities of the modern world, and it needs to reflect better the realities of a modern America. Whether that will ever happen is anyone's guess. Time will tell. It would take another constitutional Congress. And given that our current Congress seems almost incapable at times of passing even the most innocuous of laws, I personally doubt we will ever see one, at least not in our lifetimes. But if you could, what would you amend in the Constitution? And what would you revise? Remember, they're different. A revision to the Constitution would mean rewriting a clause or omitting a clause or establishing a whole new clause. An amendment simply extends the document. So which would you choose, a revision or an amendment? And what would they be? I'm Simon Salt, and this is The Rest Has Been History.
It's an interesting question, isn't it, that Simon proposes there. What would we change about the Constitution? What amendments would we make? What would I do? When I heard, of course, I got to hear that commentary a little bit earlier than you. And so as I considered that, I took the opportunity to read the Constitution and the amendments. Actually, I listened to it, and I have read parts of it. But I did pay attention and try to think of what would I change or what needs to be changed today in the Constitution. And, you know, ultimately, I don't think the Constitution needs to be changed. I think it's in general enough terms to apply to everybody. You know, when it says we the people in order to form a more perfect union, and goes on in the Constitution and it lays out the structure of the government and it lays out the checks and balances and all these things that we live by today as a nation. And, you know, Simon's exactly right. You know, at the time, our founding fathers, these people that put the Constitution into place, they weren't perfect people. They weren't perfect men. You know, they did leave people out. Slavery was accepted at that time. You know, you have the 3/5 of a person written right into the Constitution. And, you know, women weren't considered the voice of the people. It was only rich white men, right? So I understand that, and I agree with what Simon says about that. However, I also feel that those issues have been addressed. Slavery was abolished as an amendment to the Constitution. Women and people of all races and colors and creeds are given the right to vote in this country and to run for office, obviously, right? The Bill of Rights were the first amendments to the Constitution. And we'll talk more about the Bill of Rights in the future. But I really do feel that at the time the Constitution was written, it was the best document and form of government that could have been created at that time. Despite these men being imperfect, despite them being biased, despite the things that were left out at the time of the writing of the Constitution, I think it stands today. I think it represents the people of the United States. Now, we could go into a whole other conversation about politics and the parties and how the Congress and the President and the Supreme Court go about their duties and go about, you know, fulfilling the offices that are outlined in the Constitution. That's a whole different story. But as a founding document for a nation, for this nation, the United States of America, I feel that it stands today. I feel that it is valid. It is proven to be the best form of government that has been tried. One of the things that I did want to look up and find out more about was there are several instances where it talks about the Indians in the Constitution. It's pretty much always kind of an exception thing, except accounting for the Indians, meaning the Native Americans. And I'm not sure that everything's been addressed in the Constitution regarding Native Americans. And so I would definitely need to look into that further. The Native Americans have their own nations within the United States. And they have their own set of rules and their own, you know, tribe governments. And so I'm really not sure. I really don't have a lot of details about how all that works out. So I need to do more research before I say much about that. There was one thing in the, I think it's in the 9th Amendment, or the 9th article of the Bill of Rights, where it talks about, you know, all suits at common law that exceed the amount of $20 should proceed as a trial by jury. Just the amount of $20. I didn't see anything in the amendments that addressed that, or for inflation, or for anything. So, as far as I know, I guess I'd have to talk to a lawyer. but I guess, you know, if there is anything above $20, which seems pretty small today, I guess it would proceed as a trial by jury. But maybe there's something that's addressed that, and then it has to be above $200 or $100. I'm not sure what that would work out to. But I found that was interesting, that $20 in there in the Ninth Amendment. Anyway, I've talked enough. I hope everybody here in the United States has a happy 4th of July. I'm thankful to everybody out there that listens to this podcast. If you'd like to comment, you can go to journeyinto.freeforums.org and comment on this story. You can go to the Facebook page under Journey Into. You can go to Twitter on Journey Into and make a comment, or to ask me a question. I should be back real soon with some Edgar Allan Poe for you. So until then, stay safe out there and journey on.
This is Brian Lincoln from the Fullcast Podcast, and I'm here to tell you that the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. This means that while you cannot change it or sell it, you are encouraged to share it however and with whomever you would like. The theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space.